is next.
BBC.
When you want to get away from it all.
The feeling is just of being completely released from all cares and sorrows of life.
All you have to do is dream.
If I just run like wind and then if I jump, I can fly.
Take a trip on a magic carpet.
Which is literally floating on absolutely nothing.
A journey of strange vistas and enchanted landscapes.
You could see all sorts of manner of places.
Join the BBC on a mythical flight of fantasy.
The carpet's flight defies the laws of gravity, and by doing that, defies the laws of space and time.
The Magic Carpet Flight Manual. Coming soon to the BBC World Service.
There's 4 years of documentaries archived at bbcworldservice.com. Whatever your interest, you'll find award-winning radio from the BBC.
You're listening to the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. This is Europe Today with news and comment from around Europe. And coming up in the next half hour of the programme, Russians, battered by the weather extremes and fires of the summer, start stockpiling food in their homes as prices shoot up. America versus Europe, which continent would you rather be in? And British politicians saying they're angry about their mobile phones being tapped. We have the latest from the British newspaper, The News of the World. That's coming up after the news.
BBC News with Michael Poles. The former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has described radical Islam as the greatest threat facing the world. In a BBC World Service interview, Mr. Blair said those subscribing to radical Islam believe that whatever was done in the name of their cause was justified, and he said they would use chemical, biological or nuclear weapons if they could. Police in the Pakistani city of Quetta say a suicide bombing at a Shia Muslim rally has killed more than 50 people. The attack at a crowded market was the second on Shia Muslims in Pakistan in recent days. An Afghan parliamentary candidate who was injured when his convoy was hit in an airstrike has called for an investigation into the attack that left 10 of his family members dead. Abdul Wahid Khorasani said all the vehicles in his convoy had been marked with his campaign photos and banners. A six-year trial in Portugal dealing with sex abuse over many years at a state-run children's home has ended with guilty verdicts against six men and a woman. A prominent television presenter, Carlos Cruz, and a senior diplomat were among those convicted. The United Nations has called a special meeting to discuss the recent rise in food prices across the world. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization said the meeting later this month was in response to widespread concern. Police in Mozambique have fired rubber bullets and tear gas at demonstrators in the capital Maputo on the third day of protests over rising food prices. At least seven people were killed when police opened fire during the first 2 days of violence. Figures for unemployment in the United States reveal a better-than-expected rise in private sector jobs, but the jobs market overall remains weak. Last month, 67,000 new private sector jobs were created. Brazil's state oil company Petrobras has unveiled plans to sell more than $64 billion of new stock, the biggest share offering in capital market history. The money will fund deep water exploration. BBC News.
BBC World Service, this is Europe Today. The deadly fires are back in Russia. Eight people are reported to have been killed and several hundred houses set alight in the latest wave. Fires burned across much of the European Russia in August following weeks of drought and record high temperatures. Although heavy rains have helped quench the fires in much of the country, the southern regions, including Volgograd, remain hot and dry. These people in Alexandrova, one affected region, described how the fires had raged through their village.
It's burning again. The wind is getting stronger again. Our house is fine, thank God, but our neighbor's house has almost burned down.
First, the fire took hold of the shed. Then the wind blew it over to the veranda and the rest of the village. The houses have burned down. Where can we go? Some will go to live with relatives, others with friends.
No matter how hard they tried, the fire couldn't be extinguished. They started extinguishing the fence, but then everything went up in flames.
Well, the fresh fires came as Russia still had to assess the full cost of a record drought and wildfires that destroyed over a quarter of the country's crop this summer. President Putin said they'd be sending money to the areas affected.
A decree has been issued by the government. I just signed it. I'll give it to you. It concerns the allocation of additional funds for financial aid for the Volgograd and Saratov regions in the amount of 1 billion rubles. This is money to compensate citizens for damaged property. It is for the construction of the infrastructure and residential housing.
Prime Minister Vladimir Putin. Richard Galpin, our correspondent in Moscow, has been following events. I put it to him that the high temperatures were proving disastrous for the south of Russia.
Yeah, certainly it looks like that. I mean, the fact that these fires have swept through so many villages and burnt down so many homes and caused a large number of fatalities and also a significant number of people injured just shows how bad the situation is. And it does seem to be, well, certainly the authorities are saying it's due to continuing high temperatures, which have been in the region of almost 40 degrees centigrade. And in particular, of course, high winds, and they fan the flames, make the fire spread very quickly indeed. And certainly, according to one official, it's also had the effect of making power cables, electricity cables, smash into each other, causing sparks to fly off and therefore causing more fires. But the situation does sound very bad, and certainly the weather forecast suggests that the temperatures will remain up to 30 degrees centigrade for the next few days.
Are there lessons that could have been learnt from all the fires a few weeks ago, or are these different circumstances?
Well, no, I think they're similar circumstances, but there are huge underlying issues which have led to the disaster which we've seen in this country over the past few weeks. I mean, the primary problem is that they just don't have the professional people working in the forests anymore due to a reform of the law 3 years ago. And there used to be something like 70,000 forest guards who were responsible for specific parts of the forest, each of them. And this was simply abolished in this law, so you just don't have the people on the ground with the expertise who A, can monitor the forest, and B, are actually equipped and capable of fighting the fires when they first break out.
Prime Minister Putin is promising large amounts of aid money, and he's also saying it must go directly to the citizens. Do people have faith in that?
Up to a point, yeah. I mean, we just came back from the Moscow region to the east of the capital, where actually we discovered there are still fires burning. These are peat fires, but they are still burning around the Moscow region as well, despite what the authorities are saying. They're denying it. But certainly people we spoke to who've been made homeless by the fires are saying that they've been receiving cash, and they are hoping that they will be moved into new homes. And we saw houses being built in this area. But having said that, there's also been a lot of citizens' action. We went to a community centre where there was huge amounts of clothes and things which had been donated by people and by organisations. So voluntary donations also been very important in terms of providing assistance to those who've been affected by the fires.
There must be many people across Russia, those who've managed to hold on to their homes and belongings at least, who are looking forward to the winter.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's certainly been huge relief in this region when the temperatures, I mean, dropped dramatically from almost 40 degrees down to about 10 or 12, and the smog has gone, and, you know, certainly people have welcomed the rain and hoping, of course, that there's not going to be an Indian summer now and suddenly the temperature will go back up.
Richard Galpin reporting from the Russian capital. Well, Russia's ban on wheat exports after the drought and wildfires destroyed a fifth of that crop has contributed to a dramatic rise in food prices globally. The United Nations has called a special meeting to discuss the issue. It's reacting, for example, to riots in Mozambique and growing anger in several other countries over the global price rises. Masha Alexandrova is business editor of the BBC's Russian service and is with me in the studio. Masha, people are reacting quite dramatically to this in Russia. There are reports of people stockpiling food in their homes.
Well, that's true, but I would like to say that maybe the people who are stockpiling are those who remember the Soviet times, because that is what happened in the Soviet Union, when you never knew which product will disappear from the shops. So people are used to stockpiling, and as soon as there were news about price rises or maybe some shortages in certain products, people started buying things. Naturally, they're buying things that could be stored for a longer period of time. So it's mostly cereals and Russia's favorite buckwheat. But also people are stockpiling on butter or some other stuff that you could store for quite a while in the freezer. But I must say that those are the people who live on a lower income, mostly pensioners.
Is it government advice to store food? Presumably not.
No. The government is trying to do everything to stop this because it's now adding to the price rise, because all this panic buying, it just only goes into more other price rises. So the government is trying to at least follow price fixing through the competition agency or trying law enforcement to try to keep the prices low. It can do something like curb the prices, but it will only mean that the government admits that there is a shortage of food, which is not the thing at the moment.
What can the government do in terms of controlling price rises, because they did extend the embargo on exporting grain, which is exacerbating things?
Exactly. The government has the right, if the price goes over 30% in a month's time, the government has the power to put a maximum price on any product for another 90 days. But the government is not doing it at the moment because it will lead to maybe other price hikes in different regions, because prices are going up differently. In some regions, they have gone up only 5%, in some regions, 80%.
Thank you very much. That's Masha Alexandrova, business editor of the BBC's Russian service. You're with the World Service. The programme is Europe Today. Now, it began in 2005 when senior aides to the British royal family noticed there was something funny happening on their mobile phone lines, and it triggered a scandal that led to at least one journalist for one of the country's best-selling newspapers being revealed as an illegal phone tapper. Today, Britain's former Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott is demanding that police reveal whether he was targeted by the News of the World.
They have now said to me finally, "We will let you know through the lawyers on September the 10th whether we are prepared to give that information," which they've constantly denied. And now that we are waiting for that reply by September the 11th, and they failed to give us the information, which is clearly available but has to be given to us, I will seek a judicial review.
Well, the News of the World has this week confirmed that a second reporter has been suspended on suspicion of trying to gain access to celebrities' phones earlier this year. The newspaper also maintains that the practice was limited and that its then-editor, Andrew Coulson, now Director of Communications for the Prime Minister and the ruling Conservative Party, had no knowledge of what was happening. That claim was challenged by a New York Times magazine article 2 days ago, which suggested that eavesdropping efforts were more wide-ranging, in fact. The Labour MP, Tom Watson, was a member of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee, which produced a critical report into the allegations in February this year. He said there were now clear grounds for a judicial inquiry.
I think we need someone with stronger powers than our parliamentary committee. There are lots of unanswered questions with this case, and I think there's a very big suspicion that Parliament has been misled and that wrongdoing has taken place that has not been adequately investigated by the forces of law.
Steve Hewlett is a Guardian columnist and media commentator, and he joins me on the line now, The Guardian being a national British paper. Steve, you're in Spain. There are a lot of questions remaining about this, aren't there?
Well, yes. I mean, the first thing is that the New York Times has kind of, you know, reignited it. They have raised plenty of questions now about the way that the police dealt with the original information. You heard Tom Watson there. He's written a letter saying with a string of very specific demands. So there's no question that the police have had more information than they have released, and the suspicion is that the practice was much, much more widespread than the News of the World have ever acknowledged. And the reason that that is significant is because the argument that the editor of the News of the World at the time, Andy Coulson, as you pointed out now, the Prime Minister's press secretary, didn't know what was going on in his own newsroom, he's only just about sustainable when it involved his royal correspondent and a private investigator that he was on the paper's books. If it was that much more widespread, it becomes frankly incredible. So although actually when you read it, the New York Times, in terms of specific allegations about whether Andy Coulson, this is the sharp end of the story in a sense, knew what was going on, they've got a couple of unnamed sources who claim that he didn't know what was going on, but they're unnamed sources, so make of that what you will. No reason to question them, but they are unnamed. They've got one named source who, it is acknowledged, subsequently left the employ of News International with drink and drug problems, so whether that evidence would really stand the test, I suppose, must be up for question. They haven't, the truth is, as far as I can see, they haven't quite nailed Andy Coulson, but they've certainly raised questions about the press, and the News of the World, of course, is going to be fantastically embarrassed by the fact that they've now got another case where someone's had to be suspended for doing the same thing now.
Do we know how phones were allegedly tapped? Is it an easy process?
Well, it appears that quite a lot of people don't... when you get a mobile phone, you set up a voicemail account, that there's a default PIN code. Sometimes it's 40, sometimes 44, it varies. It appears that the vast majority of people don't change them. So two things were happening, as far as I understand it. One is that journalists doing this would arrange for one of them would telephone the phone number of the target to make sure that the line was engaged, so that the second one would divert to voicemail, and they would then attempt to use the factory preset codes, and in a lot of cases they would get through and be able to listen to the voicemail messages. So that's one thing. The other thing is there is some evidence that some people in mobile phone companies were either being paid or persuaded by one way or another to let these private investigators anyway give the private investigators people's specific PIN codes that they had themselves set.
And is it a peculiarly British thing, celebrity-obsessed culture? Could it happen in Spain where you are? Have you heard of it happening?
Well, I haven't heard of it happening elsewhere, and I'd be almost certain that this is, frankly, absolutely illegal as a technique. I can't imagine where it wouldn't be legal. I can't imagine anywhere where it would be legal. And I'm not aware of it happening elsewhere. I would imagine that the penalties in the US and elsewhere for doing this would be very, very severe indeed. I say it rather crept up on the British establishment. We have a tabloid press that is celebrity obsessed. Celebrity stories sell papers, and of course the other thing about this is if this had been done in order to expose some very, very serious wrongdoing, you know, corruption at senior levels in the state or something, there would have been some kind of public interest defence. As it happens, by and large, this has been done in order to try and find out who was sleeping with who.
OK, Steve Hewlett from the British newspaper The Guardian. Now, Thomas Gagan is an American working rights lawyer and journalist who evangelises about the joys of Europe in the States. He's impressed by the way he says the European model for living can help people get a better life, and he's just written a book called Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, which, as you can imagine, isn't going down too well with all Americans. On the line from his native Chicago, Tom Gagan told me why he was such a Europhile.
The gist of the book is that I feel that America has a lot to learn from Europe, but even more than that, that when I go over there as a progressive here in America, I see our own American New Deal, Franklin Roosevelt, reflected back in us in these social democracies which we helped set up after the war. And I came to feel more and more that this is European social democracy today is part of the America that we have unwittingly amputated here. I really think that it's the United States that is not getting the social democracy it deserves. I mean, we pay something like 40% of our GDP now into the public sector, and Europe generally is somewhere in the neighborhood of 47%. We do not get 47% of a European-type welfare state. And why is that? And I think it's because we don't know how to deliver public goods here, like healthcare, education, without allowing the private sector to profiteer off of them. And Europeans do socialism better. And to the extent that the U.S. is providing these sort of public goods, we can learn from the Europeans about how to deliver them.
You'd think that all was well in Europe, listening to this. And when we get down to the nitty-gritty,
everyday life isn't quite like that. Healthcare isn't perfectly provided for in Europe and so on. I mean, you've only spent about 6 months on this continent, but you must be aware of that.
Oh, of course. And to some extent, as a friend of mine said, look, you're using Europe as a battering ram against the United States. I mean, the French in the 18th century went off and wrote about Persia and idealized it to criticize the Ancien regime. But, well, education. In Europe, you have the ability to go to a school like Humboldt in Berlin practically for free. To get that same quality of education in the United States, a parent has to pay something like $50,000 in tuition. That's tuition at NYU or a comparable school. So the cash value, by American standards, of that public good is enormous. It's $50,000 a year. They're getting it for free, and we have our counterparts here who are digging deep in their pocket and going deep into debt to provide what European middle class, the European bourgeois, take for granted.
But how much of what you see is seeing daily European life through rose-tinted spectacles? For instance, you were jealous, weren't you, that some Germans finished work at lunchtime on a Friday and went home?
Of course I'm jealous. Who wouldn't be? You know, the European
model...
It's not
as if they all do.
Of course not. And there are plenty of people who are cut out of the German middle class, but there is still a broad middle class there. Whereas in the United States, it's a question of saving a broad middle class. And the European model, European social democracy, doesn't get rid of the ills of modern life. You know, a friend of mine was saying, well, you know, the French, they're so unhappy at work and so forth, you praise them, and yet I know there's a lot of dissatisfaction there. Well, of course there is. You know, I went to see Sartre's No Exit the following night. It doesn't get you out of alienation, despair, and all the other ills. But I feel that the European model is probably a glass two-thirds filled. In the United States, it's one-third filled.
Author Tom Gagan in Chicago. Abandoned land in inner-city areas can be a problem because it tends to be a magnet for fly-tipping, drug abuse, squatting and the like. It's also expensive to stop it getting overgrown, and a city council in France has found a novel solution. From Lyon, our correspondent Christian Fraser reports.
How do you clear a forgotten, tangled wilderness like this? We're deep in the heart of inner city Lyon, surrounded by brambles, trees and waist-high grass, overgrown, practically impassable to man and most machines. Yes, you could probably force your way through here with a digger or some chemical or weed killer, but what about the environmental damage and the cost? No, to most councils this would be mission impossible. Unless, of course, you had a peculiar team of specialists.
The Soay sheep, from Scotland, now employed in deepest France, clearing inner city scrubland. Lyon, like every sizeable city, has plenty of these abandoned plots. Attractive to crime and poverty, not so attractive to investors and local residents. So the council have employed this endangered animal as an experiment. Philippe Baron is from the council body Grand Lyon.
The more difficult it is to access, the more steep the land is, the more expensive labour becomes because we cannot use machines. Plots on this kind of land are the most expensive to maintain. The sheep cost the same whether it is flat or steep, and we also hope they're able to weed the same kind of acreage.
The Soay is the direct descendant of Europe's earliest domesticated sheep, much smaller than today's common breeds, not very good for wool or mutton, but extremely agile.
They run fast and they jump high, so they're very well suited to enclosed areas in the inner city like this, because they can look after themselves. But it does make them hard to round up. Oh!
I tell you what, guys, you earn your money. Yeah, this is the sound of a guilty sheep.
But they do have a voracious appetite. We were taken by the handlers, Naturama, to a field the size of 10 football pitches, which these five sheep cleared inside a month.
You are breeding them?
Yeah, sure.
I've done it well. My dad was
was a farmer specialised in south of France of olives.
The idea belongs to Christophe Darfeuil, the director of the association Naturama.
We're protecting these species. We protect also the wildlife by the new kind of managing landscape in the town, in the city. We bring nature inside the town, inside the city, and that's it.
And it's cheaper.
And it's cheaper, obviously. It's cheaper. And it creates a new kind of job.
And in a month, they will have a head shepherd. The beauty is the sheep eat, but they don't destroy.
So the Soé sheep has finally found a new function, a niche market. And for this company, it could prove a popular little earner. The company is already booked out for the rest of the year. But before you go out and buy yourself a flock like this, remember one small problem. They're very hard to catch. Come here! Come! Oh no, not that way!
Christian Fraser reporting from Lyon. Hillary Clinton, the American Secretary of State, has thanked the Palestinian and Israeli leaders for their courage and commitment for having sat around a negotiating table in Washington. The latest attempt at a Middle East peace agreement has been described as constructive in that, as one official put it, no chairs were thrown. Well, I've been talking to one man with unique insight into the process of peace negotiation. He is Thorvald Stoltenberg, former Norwegian Foreign Minister, UN High Commissioner for Refugees, and one of the main architects of the Oslo Peace Accord, which he helped forge in his kitchen between Yasser Arafat and Yitzhak Rabin in the late 80s and early 90s. Today, Thorvald Stoltenberg is 80 years old, and his son is Norway's Prime Minister. I reached him at his home in Oslo, and I asked him for his take on what had just happened in Washington.
Always when someone negotiates on the Middle East, they are always met by skepticism. And that's all right. And criticism to a certain extent, that's all right too. But one day, the critics and the skepticists will be wrong.
And do you have faith that in your lifetime we will see peace in the Middle East, lasting peace?
I'm a born optimist, but I'm 80 years old. So if I combined the optimism of my lifetime with optimism concerning peace in Middle East, I may. But I don't think it should depend on my life.
We don't know much about what was talked about in Washington. How important is secrecy, behind closed doors discussion?
Oh, very, very important. I mean, if you ask me what was the key success of the Oslo process, there were two things. One, that it was secret, very few people knew. And two, the fact that Rabin, the prime minister, turned around and supported the negotiations and the outcome of negotiations. That were the two most important factors of success.
In your case, it was secret because it happened round your kitchen table, very different from a state room in Washington.
Yeah, well, now, in all fairness, that was before the actual negotiations. The point of this was that we should get to know each other, we should get to relax, and I have never so far met a person, woman or man, who do not relax when you sit at the breakfast table and I make the breakfast. It's not made by my wife before she leaves for office. It's made by me. And I think that's a point in itself, because that means it's a very primitive breakfast. So no one gets very excited about the breakfast, but about the personal contact.
Can you ever have meaningful negotiations when you're leaving out what are, to many people, the most disagreeable players? Hamas is not involved. Doesn't that scupper the whole process?
Well, we will see. I must tell you, I know one key person in this context fairly well, and that is former Senator George Mitchell. I think if you should have a person managing to get real negotiations and peace in the Middle East, You can find no one better than George Mitchell. He doesn't tell people what to think or what to do. He asks them if that would be a good idea. And he thereby get people with him and not against him. And he combined this ability with representing the United States.
Do you think that this process finally would benefit from European involvement?
If need be. But I think the fewer involved, but the parties should of course be involved, but the fewer involved, the more chances that we get some results.
That's former Norwegian foreign minister and peace negotiator Thorvald Stoltenberg speaking from his home in Oslo earlier. Thanks for listening to Europe Today. We're back tomorrow. See you then.